Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
One of the things that I feel like is so beautiful about the brain is how we are driven to gain new knowledge. The brain evolved to have the opportunity to gain knowledge coded as a reward.
I love the idea that there is basically a neurobiological, physiological connection between that thing where we all went into lockdown and people said, right, I'm going to get a sourdough starter and I'm going to learn how to bake bread. And the people who are going, we're going to need a vaccine for this. I'm going to go off to my lab. I'm going to work out how to fix it. There's a bird singing outside my window. The other day, I saw an actual daffodil poking through the soil. The snowdrops are out. No, I'm not making this up. Warmer times and longer days are just around the corner. And this is an optimistic episode of Politics on the Couch. As regular listeners know, we like to find a streak of optimism in our political and psychological analysis. Hello, regular listeners. New listeners, welcome. For this episode, we're delving deep into the psychology and the politics of optimism. Not feeling it? Maybe the pandemic is weighing you down. Well, even then, you might be surprised to know how skewed your expectations are towards the upside. Research into attitudes and personal predictions has found that most of us have a baked-in optimism bias. We know about all the bad stuff that happens, but we kind of expect it to happen to other people. We overestimate the likelihood of good things, big and small, that will happen to us in the coming weeks, months, and years. We start up businesses and expect them to succeed. Most of them fail. We get married, knowing about the divorce rate, but absolutely confident that all the splitting up is done by other couples. In surveys, most of us will judge ourselves to be better than average drivers, better than average friends and lovers. But we can't all be better than average. I know, disappointing, right? So what's going on here, and what does it mean for the way we vote and the decisions that politicians make? To help answer some of those questions, I spoke to Tali Sharrett. She is Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at the Department of Experimental Psychology, University College London. She's also a Wellcome Trust Senior Research Fellow and Director of something called the Effective Brain Lab. Professor Sharrett wrote the book on optimism bias. I mean, literally, that is the title of one of her books, and it is excellent. A really engaging, colourfully narrated introduction to some very profound brain stuff. Check it out. Tali Sharrett has also written an award-winning follow-up book about the psychology of changing minds and behaviour. That one's called The Influential Mind, and we get onto some of that material too in the podcast, mainly with reference to the pandemic and climate change. We talked about a lot, in fact, but I began with optimism. And because it's a word that's bandied around quite casually, I started by asking Professor Sharrett to explain exactly what it means in the specific context of a psychological bias.
The optimism bias is our tendency to believe that things would be better than what they end up being, or better than what the data in front of us would suggest. So it means that your expectations are better than the outcomes, right?
Is there a lot of, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, is there a lot of variance per per person, per individual in that? I mean, again, sort of commonly one assumes there is such a thing as an optimistic temperament, whereas what I understand from your research is more or less everyone has some hardwired tendency to overestimate the likelihood of a good outcome in the future relative to the present.
Right, and underestimate the likelihood of negative outcomes as well. But I just wanted to make the point that, let's say you have a negative expectation, so you think you're going to lose money at this in the stock market, and you actually do lose money, but you lose more than you expected. That's still an optimism bias. So you can have a negative expectations, but if they're not as negative as they should be, that's still an optimism bias. Now, with regard to individual differences, yes. So what we see is that we see the optimism bias in about 80% of the population. There's many different experiments that measure optimism bias in different ways, in different domains. Most of them come up with about 80% of the population. So that means that 20% of the population does not have an optimism bias. Those 20%, half of them tend to have a pessimistic bias. So they expect things to be worse than they end up being. A lot of those people do have depression, usually severe depression. And then you have 10%, so that's half of that 20%, that don't have a bias either way. These people tend to have mild depression. And when I say they don't have a bias, it doesn't mean that they are accurate. It just means that the systematic mistakes that they make, well, it's not systematic. They make mistakes, but they are not systematic. So sometimes they expect things to be a little bit better, sometimes a little bit worse. On average, if you know, average these errors, then you get no bias at all. And the 80% that do have an optimism bias, indeed, there's a range, right? You can go from mild optimism bias, which is in fact most of the population has a mild optimism bias, and then all the way to extreme optimistic biases.
It seems to me there's a possible distinction between optimism regarding outcomes sort of in the universe that are going to affect me and optimism about my own agency in the universe. So most people think they're better drivers than the average person, which obviously statistically they can't be. But also, as you say, that the stock market is going to turn out well for me. Those seem to be two slightly different categories of way of looking at the world. But we're optimistic on both fronts. Is that right?
So no. And you raise a really important point that has a few different components in it. So first of all, what we see is what I call, and other people call as well, private optimism and public despair. So we tend to see this optimistic bias regarding to ourselves, right? So things that relate to ourselves, also maybe like our family members to some extent, but not necessarily to things that relate to the world at large. So you're not necessarily optimistic about the abilities of the leaders in your country, not necessarily optimistic about global issues. However, when those issues are tightly related to your outcomes, like stock market, right? So if you put money in the stock market, you may become more optimistic about it. If you don't have the money in the stock market, then it doesn't matter for you, and then you don't necessarily have this optimism bias. But you actually raised another important point, which is what role does agency play here? And it plays an important role, which is we are more optimistic about those things that we believe we can control. Whether we can control them or not is another thing. But the reason is if I think I can control my own destiny, well, of course, I will, you know, drive in the right direction. And that's why we're optimistic. And in fact, people do think that they have more control over their lives than they actually do. And that's the reason that they're optimistic, and they're not so optimistic about these global issues, partially because they don't think that they can control them.
That's very interesting. So if I've understood that right, there is almost a kind of a feedback loop where we want to feel we have control and agency over the world, although naturally because of the way the universe operates, that's unlikely to be true a lot of the time. But we sort of exaggerate our capability in that respect, which then feeds back into this general tendency we have to think that we're better at stuff than we are. So we then amplify the control component, which makes us optimistic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, part of the reason that we believe we have more control over things than we actually do is that, I'll tell you about an experiment that kind of shows it. So there's a classic experiment where people are asked to press a button and they see the light going on or off. And there is no relationship between whether they press the button and whether the light went on and off in reality. But people believe that they do, right? They kind of conclude out of their experience that they have control because they have a tendency to kind of pay attention more to those outcomes that are consistent with their intention. versus those outcomes that were not consistent with their intention. And that study, for example, didn't see that in depressed individuals. And that goes back to this idea, depressed individuals have less of a tendency to have an illusion of control. And this is one of the reasons that they have less of a tendency to have an optimism bias. They have pessimistic bias. They think, well, I can't control anything. I can't direct it in the right direction. It's probably just going to go all really bad for me.
There's a kind of risky conclusion one could draw here, which is that the mildly depressed people have the more realistic appraisal of how much agency they actually have. And to the extent, I don't want to be too philosophical about this, but to the extent that you could posit an actual empirical model of the world, the slightly depressed person is more right about that than the average person who's in the 80% who are optimistic.
Yeah, so there are studies that support exactly what you said. So there are studies supporting the idea that mildly depressed individuals have a more realistic view of their control over outcomes. Some studies contradict this, so it's a little bit of, you know, muddy, but I think there is some support for this idea.
In terms of how much that's conditioned by, because I don't want to depress our listeners too much, you know, the universe isn't against you, don't worry. But in terms of how much that's conditioned by the environment, you know, you made this point that people can be quite pessimistic about the public environment as distinct from what's going to happen to them individually. Do we know much about how that changes in different sort of periods or time? So I'm just thinking basically about the pandemic at the moment. We're at what I would think would be a kind of a pessimisticogenic environment where people are likely to be made pessimistic. Is that what you would expect? Or is it the opposite, that because we're in gloomy times, somehow we sort of mine our own optimism deeper to counteract that?
We have done some research about optimism and people's beliefs during the pandemic. I think the first finding is, which is not surprising perhaps, but very interesting, people are extremely optimistic about their own likelihood of being infected. So people believe they are less likely to be infected by COVID than other people of their same age and gender. And we see this on a large, diverse population. So, of course, for each individual, if you tell me I'm less likely to be infected than other people my age and gender, maybe you're right? I mean, it could be. But if you take a diverse population and you see that on average they have that belief, that cannot be right? So people do have that belief, but at the same time, they believe that COVID. Well, these studies we have done, it may have shifted a little bit, but at least up until about June, people had believed that the pandemic and COVID is a severe danger to the population. So they had, again, this kind of private optimism, but public despair. They thought, okay, I'm probably better off than other people, but this is quite a threat for the human population. So there was a little bit of optimism there. But also this kind of global pessimism. But I think what is, to me, the most incredible finding with regards to how people have handled this situation is the fast adaptation. We started looking at people's mental health and well-being just a few weeks after it all started in March. And we saw a significant decrease in happiness, a significant increase in stress. And when I say significant, I mean statistically significant, but the effect itself wasn't as large as you would expect. Only a month later, they already went back to baseline levels of happiness. Stress was still above your normal levels, but happiness went to baseline within only 4 weeks. People adapted very, very quickly. They changed, you know, how they live their lives. And on average, there was really great adaptation, which on one hand was extremely surprising. On the other hand, there is so much research that show how rapidly humans adapt to very extreme circumstances, you know, losing a loved one, getting divorced, unemployment. It's quite amazing.
And to adapt in surprising ways to good things as well. So lottery winners sort of revert to the mean of how happy or unhappy they would have been once they've got used to the fact that they've got millions more in the bank. What is the sort of evolutionary or adaptive process that's going on there that means we external events actually sort of only temporarily seem to dent our base level of happiness and we default back to a relatively constant position, if I've expressed that right?
Yeah. Well, I think we have to look at the two effects separately. One effect is my environment is becoming worse. There's something threatening has gone on, something terrible happened, and I adapt. Well, here, the adaptive value is quite clear, right? I mean, the humans have evolved specifically to quickly adapt to their environment. This is exactly the number one thing that the brain is set up to do, and our bodies as well. I mean, the rest of our bodies. The brain is very, very flexible. You come into the world and you just learn and adapt to the situation, and it continues being flexible. Our brain can adjust, and it does it extremely well. And the adaptive value here is clear, right? We need to adapt. Something, you know, there's no more food, the temperature is different, we need to adapt, and we do that. So that's the adaptive value. In terms of why is it that when things become much, much, much better, we also go back to baseline? And the way, just to say, the way that we adapt to these negative situations is we change. It's not like magic, right? We change what we do. Right? We actually act to make things better, right? So instead of meeting in person, now we're meeting in Zoom, and people start cooking for themselves instead of going to restaurants. I mean, we just do what needs to be done to get to where we need to go. When things become much better, after a while, we again adapt to our environment and go back to baseline levels of happiness. When you ask what the adaptive value is, it's not super clear, but potentially one option is that we need to strive for something, right? In order to have a motivation to develop and, you know, invent new stuff and be creative, we need a need. So being very unhappy is not necessarily good, but being extremely joyful all the time also may not actually be very good for our survival, because we need something to drive us to want more, to explore, to learn.
That's fascinating. So we need to have this capacity to imagine, to be dissatisfied with the present, to imagine something better in the future, which we then aspire to. And it's, yeah, I suppose you can see how that's good for evolution. You know, going back to the pandemic and the way we've responded to behaviours, whether being overly optimistic in that environment can lead to some bad political choices and political outcomes, both at the personal level, as in, you know, I might get a bit complacent about washing my hands because frankly it's not going to happen to me, but also at the policy level, where politicians are thinking that is kind of like the flu. I mean, you saw this in the early stages of the UK government handling of the pandemic, which is all of their sort of base assumptions and the way they'd anchored their view of what the policy procedure should be were hopelessly optimistic. I don't think that's even a partisan statement. I think privately they'd probably say that themselves.
Yes. So this is, you know, the pandemic is really kind of a, you know, textbook case of optimism, where there is a lot of advantages to being optimistic and even being optimistically biased. If we expect things to go well, it gives us a motivation to act, right? If you think, okay, I'm going to do really well in my job, you actually, you know, act to do that. You think, I'm going to get a promotion. Well, you do what you need to do to get there. If you think, well, I'm never going to get that promotion, then you don't try, right? So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because expectations drive actions, actions drive outcomes. However, on the negative side, if you think, well, everything's going to be okay, you may not take precautionary action, not wear a helmet when you bike, not buy insurance when you should in these cases. And so the pandemic is just another example where if we are too optimistic and we have problems in seeing not even the worst case scenario, but, you know, just the likely scenario is, that can cause great harm. And in this case, death. The problem in this case is not just optimism. It is that it's very difficult to imagine something so different from what we know. And this is something that is a hurdle, not only for response to pandemic, but also things like climate change. We are trying to deal with something that, at least with the pandemic, when it just started, we can't imagine. It's, you know, it hasn't happened to us in our lifetime, although the pandemic has happened, in the course of history. But in those cases, it's very hard to imagine what the consequences will be, because when we can imagine things in detail, we think they're more likely. There's this relationship between how easy and how detailed your imagination is and the probability you assign to that event. I think there's at least two reasons that caused people to focus on unrealistic outcomes, I guess.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So let me sort of just backtrack a bit so I've fully understood this. So the way in which we can construct a sort of an ideation of the future is going to be more plausible, more credible, but if we can make that picture more detailed. And from I think what I've understood from what your book actually is that part of the reason that is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is because we have to excavate our own previous experience to construct an idea of the future. So we find it very difficult to project things in the future that we have no personal resource from in our past that fuels our imagination. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So the way that we imagine things in the future is we take little bits and pieces of experiences in our past. And it doesn't have to be our own experiences. It could be things like other people's experiences or things that you read in books, but a lot of it is things that actually happened to you. And then you take those bits and pieces, you put them together to construct something new. And in fact, that is a function of memory. So the function of memory is not necessarily to remember the past, it is to imagine the future. Right? That's what memory is there for, to help you make better decisions as you go forward.
Speaking kind of evolutionarily, if I remembered that saber-toothed tigers, caveman brain me remembers that saber-toothed tigers hide behind certain kinds of rocks, that's a useful thing to remember from the past so that next time I see those kind of rocks, I don't get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger and then I'm more likely to survive as a species.
Right. And what our brain can do, it doesn't take these memories as a video-like print. But you have to kind of think to yourself, well, I saw these specific two lions, behind these specific two rocks, but then you generalize, right? There are lions here that can be behind rocks, they can be behind big bushes and so on, right? So this is where imagination comes in because it creates something new by restructuring a lot of things. And if you think about things like, paintings by Dali, for example, it's this idea that you can take different things that are not necessarily, you don't necessarily see them together at a certain point in time, but you combine them to make something new. And this is in fact why our memories are not necessarily very accurate. Because when we kind of recall a memory, again, we don't actually recall a video of what happened, but we recall a reconstruction of what happened. And that can actually cause a lot of mistakes in memory. Those mistakes are perhaps, not as bad because they come from a system that allows us to imagine new things.
Right. So even the kind of what they call flashbulb memories, which are the classic things of I remember exactly where I was when Kennedy was assassinated, or I remember exactly where I was on 9/11. Actually, it turns out you don't. I mean, you remember broadly where you were, but the clarity, the intensity, as I understand it, of those memories is an imprint of the emotional impact more than an actually detailed photographic representation of the moment.
Right. And what's interesting about the flashbulb memories is that for most memories in the past, you're not sure that you remember them quite accurately. You think, oh, I saw this person, I'm not quite sure where or when, But for flashbulb memories, which are memories of very arousing events, which could be negative or positive, it could be your wedding, it could be the birth of your kid, it could be an accident, it could be the death of Diana. So it's positive or negative. You have this feeling that you remember that with great detail and accuracy, while in fact, those memories are not much more accurate than any other memories. And that's why these are especially interesting. And the reason that we have this feeling is that these events are, they seem to be important, right? They have this kind of stamp that says, this is an important thing. It probably has high significance. And this is what emotion does. Emotion highlights and brings your attention to those things that are important. They could be good. You want to do them again. They could be bad. It's something that you want to avoid. In either case, it could be things that have impact on the rest of your life.
I have a slight hypothesis now that pops into my head with regard to this that might be completely wrong. If memory has that function and we're constructing an idea of the future based on the resource we have to draw on from the past, and also that is then feeding or the optimism bias to the extent that, we imagine the future from a sort of a best interpretation available of what we liked from the past. There is a sort of inherent conservatism, small c conservatism, in the way we're looking at the future. I was just thinking back to what you were saying, which was really interesting about how difficult it is to sort of engage with problems like climate change, or another one would be the aging of the population, social care. No one really wants to concentrate very hard on imagining themselves getting very old and decrepit. So we simply don't. You know, we sort of know it's going to happen at some stage, but we blank it out. I wonder if that means, in sort of political terms, some of these biases go with the grain of a kind of a conservative way of looking at the future, that we don't really want to engage with radical, drastic solutions or ideas, because that's not the way our brains are kind of wired to think about the future.
So it is true that on average, the average person will find solutions that are not radical, right? Solutions that are closer to what we have experienced. The good thing is that we have a range of people with a range of ideas and so on and so on. And all you need is to have a few people that happen to come up with these radical ideas. And if they have, you know, enough power and so on, these people with radical ideas sometimes are able to take those ideas and change the rest of us. And it's a bit like a mutation, I guess you can think about it, right? You know, evolution is that the DNA goes along and then suddenly there's one mutation. It could be by accident, but that mutation ends up to be something that's extremely helpful. And so it replicates itself. So I think we could, you know, people talk about memes and so on. Ideas are a little bit like that. Yes, most of the ideas will be, you know, mainstream down the line, but then you have once in a while these ideas that are really different, but also very helpful. And they do take on and change what we do as a species.
It also gives tremendous potential power in a good and a bad way, sort of a value neutral way, to leaders or individuals who are able to project their imagination into other people's imaginations. So basically the function of inspiration, that the people who have that are that little bit more imaginative or creative or articulate in expressing it, the ability to animate that in other people becomes the presumably central to charismatic leadership.
Right. So if I understand you correct, you mean communication?
Yeah, basically. You said in one word what I managed took about 2 minutes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. because you have to do two things. First of all, you have to have this different idea that hopefully is also a helpful and good one. But then, of course, if it just stays in your head, that's not enough, right? You have to be able to take that idea out of your head into the world and convince other people that this is a good idea. And I guess that kind of relates a little bit to my second book, The Influential Mind, where I talk about how can you convince people, you know, who are the good people, who's good at doing this and why.
In the optimism bias, where you talk about elevation, which is this really interesting concept in terms of what a good speech or a good rhetorician will do that will give people that sense of uplift and animate their optimism. Presumably that is related to this question of how you persuade, how you convince people. You're tapping into the natural tendency people have to want to be uplifted and to feel optimistic.
Yeah, so emotion in general is something that we pay attention to. And that's true with a whole range of emotions, not just positive, but also negative. We do pay attention more if you arouse fear or anger or to some extent sadness, but it's mostly this high arousing emotions that people are attending to more, but also excitement and surprise, right? But also hope. So anything that is emotional, we pay attention to. The reason is quite obvious, because we have evolved to pay attention to things that are arousing because most of the time they're important. So that is one thing that's important. The other thing that's important is whether there is a story, right? When people can convey a message within a story, we tend to remember it better. We tend to think about it more rather than just data. So this is a problem that a lot of us have, like scientists, right? We come in, we say, here's a graph, here's the data, you know, here, vaccine works. And people just don't listen to it, don't necessarily remember to it, don't pay attention to it. And again, it's because we have evolved over millions and millions of years to learn from stories. We learned from what happened to people around us in the village and in our family. We take examples and then we conclude things. And now we have better tools to both gather data and as well as analyze it to get to those conclusions. But we still pay attention to stories, and stories are still something that affect us to a great degree. And so to convey a message, we need to rely on our data, right? But the data would not be enough to convince something of the truth.
And these are different parts of the brain, as I understand it. So you, that sort of emotional arousal bit is the amygdala, crudely speaking, which is the earlier evolved bit of the brain. And that's where, you know, an emotive picture or an image, whether literally a photograph that will get people, you know, emotionally driven. If you think about the way political advertising works, obviously you use certain images to get the emotional sort of glands pumping, overriding the sort of prefrontal cortex, which is the bit that would actually analyze, actually, how much am I at risk of a terrorist attack? Or actually, how bad is crime? Or should I be as afraid of this as this politician wants me to be? So there is that, am I right in thinking that's basically a tension you describe between the sort of different ways we take in information is literally a contest between different parts of our brain over how we judge information.
So that's a popular narrative. And I guess there's a little grain of truth, or there's a grain of truth in it, but it's not quite right. So it is true that the way that our brain evolved is it started off with the very low levels to just have us move. Had another part and that the brainstem. And then it had another part, which is, amygdala and so on, which is also important for arousal and so on. And then it had finally the neocortex, which is what mammals have and humans have, a especially large one. First of all these regions, whether they are old in evolutionary history or new, are connected to each other. There is feedback loops. They do not work alone, ever. Second of all, because both emotion and I wouldn't say the word rational, but, you know, making decisions that are helpful in to gain reward and avoid harm is important for both low-level animals and high-level animals, it is not the case that one region only does one thing. What do I mean? Well, let's start with humans. For us, emotion is not something that is distracting. It's giving us information. It's a very, very important part of the information that comes in order to make a decision. We would not want to live without emotion. And in fact, people who have damage to both amygdalas have a hard time in many things. It's not something that is, oh, that's distracting me from making the right decision, the rational decision. No, it's helping you in many, many ways. And we can kind of talk about different examples. Second of all, the low levels, such as the amygdala, they do quite sophisticated computations to figure out what's good. So if you think about the first organisms, they had to make decisions, like they had to move towards the sun, towards warmth, sorry. They had to move towards water, right? They had to make these decisions. And in order to make them, they had to have some kind of sophisticated computations. And they could do that with very, you know, simple machinery. I don't really like this distinction, and I understand where it's coming from, but it's not the case. The old parts of our brain, they do things, and they do things extremely well, and they are not there to interfere. They're there to help. And the neocortex, on the other hand, it actually has lots of biases, right? Now, where this kind of dichotomy is correct is that it is true that the neocortex, for example, is important for language, right? So these kind of abstract concepts and these kind of things. But on the other hand, these low-level regions turned out to be very important to drive us to want to know, to gain knowledge. So that is very much the needs to gain knowledge is very much related to areas in the midbrain. Very, very, you know, old evolutionary regions that drive you to have all those books behind you.
That's fantastically important, because you're absolutely right that there is this crude dichotomy that, you know, I've almost certainly been guilty of it, not just in this conversation, but in other conversations as well, that wants to see the sort of, as you almost blame, kind of caveman brain for getting me into all sorts of trouble. And then I think a lot of people think that there is a sort of hyper-rational scientific bit, you know, scientist comes in and basically puts caveman on a leash, and then you manage your biases accordingly, and you get towards better outcomes. And from what you just said, particularly that last bit, that the will to learn and the will to acquire all this information is such a primal urge and part of our survival impulse, that I hadn't really kind of understood that relationship properly. And it connects, I think, to something that you've written about or spoken about, which is that sometimes people, you know, who perform very well in high cognitive functions, great mathematicians, can be more subject to certain cognitive biases because they apply that capability, that thinking, to justifying the decisions that are actually driven by their biases rather than challenging their biases.
Yes, absolutely. This is why when you kind of try to like pinpoint how bias works, both like neurally and computationally, you find it to arise, not necessarily from those lower levels. Right. And you're absolutely right. And this is one study that I like a lot, that I talk about many times is from Don Kahan at Yale University, where, he looked at individuals and he wanted to know who's really good at math and analytical skills and who's not so good. So he gave 1,000 individuals a math test, divided them into those with really good math skills, those with not so good math skills, and then gave them 2 data sets to look at. One data set was, looking at whether skin, lotion was helping skin rush. And he said, okay, look at the data, analyze the data, tell me whether this lotion is helping. And those with better math skills did better at this, and, you know, gave the correct answer. Then he gave them another data set. And this data set, he said, is looking at whether gun control laws are reducing crime. So look at the data, analyze the data, and tell me whether the gun control laws are indeed reducing crime. And what he found here was that, first of all, people did much worse than the skin lotion task. Because here, people had very strong beliefs about whether gun control should reduce or will reduce. And they had very strong preferences regarding whether they wanted gun control or not. And those beliefs and preferences interfered with their ability to analyze the data. And relatively speaking, those with better math and analytical skills actually did worse. Because it seems that what they were doing is they weren't necessarily using their skills to find the truth, but rather to find faults that with the data, because, you know, that they were unhappy with.
If I understand this right, the intensity of how strongly you feel about that, like I feel much more strongly about gun issues than I do about skincare issues. And therefore, there's going to be a correlation between the strength of that feeling and my resistance to me changing my mind on that subject, and the amount of reasoning capability that I bring to it is more likely to tilt towards reinforcing my prejudice than it is to actually understanding the data or unpicking the prejudice.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're absolutely also right that if we didn't have a neurocortex, we won't be able to read data, right? We won't be able to do math, well, not explicitly. But on the other hand, that's not to say that the neurocortex is this kind of like rational, non-biased organ, and is just getting this kind of interference from below.
There is a danger, I think, in around all this stuff that either that you get into a very jaundiced view of the way politics works, because, and this relates to this slightly false dichotomy that we've been talking about, where you think the successful politicians and the candidates are the ones that are gaming a kind of a weakness in the human brain and are going with the grain of all sorts of biases and are playing that system well. And the less successful politicians are the ones who are falling, you know, who aren't good at narrative or who are trying to solve problems with spreadsheets and maths rather than anything else. Is that an unfair account of sort of what does and doesn't work in terms of persuading people and by extension politics? I'm just bluntly speaking, I'm thinking of someone like Boris Johnson, who's extremely successful in politics at a certain level by persuading people to do things that his critics would say aren't such a great idea. I think there is a jaundiced view of him would be, well, all he's doing is very effectively gaming the bits of the brain that make us wrong about stuff rather than helping people to get these questions right.
Yeah. So whether someone automatically or consciously uses stories and emotion and, you know, triggers hope in people and so on to get them to believe a certain things, on its own, that's not evil. In fact, it's necessary. In Influential Mind, I start with this story of the debate for presidential candidates for the Republicans in 2016, where it was a debate between Donald Trump and Dr. Ben Carson. And they were talking about all sorts of things. And then the moderator said to Ben Carson, you know, Donald Trump many times has talking about this association between childhood vaccines and autism. You're a doctor, you know, you're a physician. What do you have to say about this? And Ben Carson said, well, look, there's a lot of data, a lot of studies showing that there isn't a relationship between the two. He's an intelligent man, he said about Donald Trump. Once he sees the data, he will be convinced otherwise. And then the moderator turns to Donald Trump and asks him, what do you think? So then Trump goes into the story about an employee that he had, and the employee had a small child, and the child got vaccinated. And then finally, some time later, the child got autism. And listening to this, I had a strong reaction to that story. At the time, actually, my son, my second child, was about 8 weeks old. And I had a strong reaction. It kind of, although I knew the data and I know, you know, all the science and all of that, it got me thinking. I don't know. It just, I had this reaction. And once I had the reaction, I thought to myself, well, this is interesting, right? Why am I having this reaction? If I'm having a reaction, I'm a neuroscientist. I'm trained to make conclusions based on data. And not only am I I'm a neuroscientist, so I know a little bit about autism as well. And yet I'm affected by this one story told by Donald Trump, right? That's kind of crazy. But on the other hand, I think Ben Carson missed something here, right? He had an opportunity to convince perhaps millions, perhaps thousands of people to vaccinate their kids. And he wasn't successful at all, right? And so this is problematic, because at the end of the day, by not taking into account how the brain works, by not taking into account the fact that to have people understand what you're saying, you have to go beyond the data. It's a problem. So I don't think that using stories or using emotions such as hope, for example, is problematic per se. What's problematic is that when you're using it to, you know, for evil, I guess, or you're using it and it's misaligned with the facts.
So the Ben Carson thing there, what he should have done, something more along the lines of just remember how, you know, what smallpox was, what polio was, and tell the story of the children walking in calipers who are suffering from polio and how that doesn't happen anymore and our children are running around free. You can imagine how you would construct that story. Right. So suddenly it's an uplifting narrative of hope and vaccines did this and we can do this again today and get to a brighter tomorrow. I'm no expert, but I imagine that would be the way to frame that a little bit better. What is the equivalent sort of narrative or more emotionally resonant mechanism that you can use to overcome that optimism bias, that problem that we were talking about earlier with regard to something like climate change or an aging population? What works to get people to focus on scary things in the future in a sustained enough way that you can actually start talking about the solutions? That's a really big question, and I'm sorry if there isn't an answer to it.
There's a few problems in convincing people about climate change. One is, it's way in the future. It's probably not going to mostly affect us, but other generations. Doesn't mean that it's not going to affect us, but the real, real strong effects are going to be for the future generations. So that's the first problem, because people kind of mostly care about their outcomes. And perhaps their kids, but going way into, like, you know, the next generation, it's a little bit problematic. As we said, it's hard to imagine these events. And finally, these are negative events. We don't like to dwell on negative events and imagine them if we don't really need to. There's some cases where we need to, and we can talk about that. So that's problematic. And also, there's another problem, which we feel we don't have any control. The way that it's usually conveyed is, well, maybe you can recycle. But on the other hand, there's lots of data saying, well, recycling is not going to be, that's not the solution, right? So you kind of feel like, well, what can I do anyway? So you don't have control, right? And control, as we said, is quite important. There's, I guess, uncertainty about the exact outcomes, although we know this is going to happen. But how is, you know, what exactly is going to happen? We don't know. It's going to be bad. But it's hard to kind of know exactly, you know, when and what and so on. So all of these are very problematic. And also, finally, very, very important, the solutions tend to be framed as we're going to lose. That is, in order to solve this problem, we need to consume less, right? It's all these negative things that you're going to have to do in order for future generations to have more. than they would otherwise. I think the important thing here is to try to reframe it as much as we can, as we will do these things and actually it will generate positive outcomes. For example, in order to fight climate change, we need to come up with all these new technologies, right? And these technologies can, in fact, at the end of the day, as a side effect, affect us positively now.
People are very, very loss averse, aren't they? And that's another sort of bias in effect, that we put a much higher price on what we've got now being under threat than we do on the hypothetical good thing we might have in the future. So you have to really work hard to persuade people. If you start with the proposition, this is going to involve a huge sacrifice from you in terms of your lifestyle, you're going to have to give up your car, you're going to have to drive a smaller car, all that sort of stuff. Immediately, you're triggering resistance in people's minds. Is that roughly right?
Yeah. So there's the temporal discounting, which is we find things now in the present more important than things in the future, in, you know, on average. And then it's just, in this case, we're losing, and mostly the framing is we're not going to gain, someone else is going to gain, right? So it's not even your average loss aversion. It's just like, oh, you have to sacrifice, but you're not going to gain anything. When that is not necessarily true and can certainly be reframed as this will help you, this will create jobs, this will create a better future, you know, just having better air quality can affect your own health. Or even, you know, let's talk about, you know, traveling less and so on. On one hand, you know, people like to travel, they like to go on vacations and so on, but they don't necessarily like business travel that much, and saying, well, this is great now, we can do a lot of this over Zoom, right? You get more time, you know, with your family and so on. That's a positive. So if we can kind of focus mostly on the positive outcomes and not necessarily focus on what you can't do, right? Don't eat meat, don't travel and so on.
I was reading something you'd written about the different explanatory styles that people have, depending on, you know, whether they're slightly more depressed in their outlook or prone to depression or more optimistic, that the way you narrate the world around you makes a big difference. So something bad happens to you, one fork in the road goes to this terrible thing happened to me because these things always happen to me and I'm slightly useless and I'm not good in relationships or I can't do my job properly, and you go down a negative path. Or you think, you know, stuff happens in the world. It's, you know, it wasn't really my fault. In fact, my boss was a bit of a asshole anyway, so I'm better off without that job. And you go down. And so whether those sort of personal explanatory modes that people can move between can be extrapolated to a more sort of wider collective social way we describe problems to ourselves.
You can think about it in this way, but you still need to emphasize the positive outcomes for the individual, not only for society, not only for others, also for an individual. And it can be silly things. I mean, in our department, in the university, they give out these kind of green awards, you know, for the department who does the best, you know, most of the green action and so on. This really motivates people. I mean, really, people in the department go out of their ways to come up with new strategies and they do it for good. But also it's a motivator to see like, oh, we've won the green awards 10 years in a row or something. So they care about their outcomes. And if you can align personal outcomes with social outcomes, that is, of course, the best.
So essentially that thing that we did when we were raising our children when they were little, when I had toddlers, and you sort of have a little sticker chart. And if you eat all your greens, you get a sticker. And then at the end of the week, you get a lollipop. You know, we haven't really stopped being responsive to that sort of technique as adults. You can still use that, you know, immediate reward gratification to build towards the positive outcome, which is, as I vaguely remember from parenting my young children, when you remember to get it right, which isn't always the case, much more effective than just shouting at them and saying, don't do that or this bad thing will happen, or worse still, don't do that because I say don't do it and I'm a parent, you just have to do as I say. That, you know, when you remember to do the sort of positive reinforcement thing, it works. And then so presumably, if I understand you rightly, it works at a social policy level as well, if we get it right.
And it definitely works on adults. I mean, all you have to do is open Twitter or Facebook. And it's always kind of like, it's absolutely amazing to me. But on the other hand, I can absolutely understand it. People go out of their ways for those little likes and hearts and retweets. I mean, every little like or heart gives people a little boost to the ego, a little tiny reward. adults of all ages really care about these things, and they will go out of their way for these, you know, positive feedbacks, these immediate positive feedbacks. So if there hasn't ever been any doubt about it, I think social media has shown us that we look like adults, but we're definitely children inside in many ways. And if you tap into that little child, it's amazing. The effect is amazing, which is what social media has done, right? And basically, social media taps into kind of your childish instincts, and it's super effective.
Yeah, it sort of gamifies social interaction. And that's happening, as I understand it, at a chemical, neurological chemical level. You're getting the same, you know, it's the sort of the little dopamine hit that you get. It would be similar to the one that activated, I mean, I'm an ex-smoker, you know, so the one that would be activated by a narcotic in some way, that it's literally addictive, getting that little sense of reward all the time.
Yeah, so the reward system is in charge of processing all these different rewards. It might be, it's depending on the reward, it could be a little bit different, but in general, yes. There are what we call primary rewards, which is things that you need to for immediate survival, water, food, and then there's sex, which is also considered a primary reward. And then you have secondary rewards. These are things that are associated with primary rewards, so things like money. You get money, you can't eat money, but you can take the money to buy some food. And then you have these more what we call kind of cognitive rewards, which is even learning something new is rewarding. So gaining knowledge can actually be very rewarding as well. But definitely social feedback, positive social, even a smile, right? When you see someone smile, this is why smiley faces work quite well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Interesting. But particularly that point about taking new information, when you have that kind of aha moment, the eureka moment is not a sort of, I mean, it is obviously about a rational process that's gone on, but I hadn't really made that connection before. It's associated, it's a much more visceral, emotional thing that you're getting that same sense of satisfaction. And we probably, if you were sort of to draw up the list of things that make you feel good or things that might improve the quality of your life, you'd think, well, if I had a bit more money, or, you know, if I had a bigger house or a nicer car, or the sorts of things people put on those lists, most people would probably forget to put learning new stuff. But that it presumably does actually substantially increase your sense of well-being.
Yes. I think one of the things that I feel like is so beautiful about the brain is how the way that we are driven to gain new knowledge is that the brain evolved to have the opportunity to gain knowledge coded as a reward, just like food and water and so on. And so it kind of hijacks the same neural structures and it uses the same algorithms that are already used to get you out of your house to get water, food, and sex. And it uses the same algorithms and neural structure to drive you to get new information because it is important for survival, right? It may not be so much the immediacy of that survival, right? It's not like if you don't eat, you're, you know, going to die after a short amount of time. If you don't learn something new in a week, you're not going to die. But in the long run, we need that in order for example, be able to overcome things like pandemic, right? It is that drive for knowledge that drove people to learn new things. And when the time comes, it does help humans to survive, to get over the pandemic, and hopefully get over climate change as well.
I love the idea that there is basically a neurobiological, physiological connection between that thing where we all went into lockdown and people said, right, I'm going to get a sourdough starter and I'm going to learn how to bake bread. And the people who are going, we're going to need a vaccine for this. I'm going to go off to my lab. I'm going to work out how to fix it. That was one of those superficially, well, actually in practice, looks substantially more important and valuable than the other one. I'm glad we've got a vaccine. I'm relaxed about sourdough. But actually the fact that the impulse, the human impulse, is sort of the same in both cases, if I've understood what you're telling me correctly, is magnificent. I mean, what a great species we are. I'm completely convinced.
Absolutely. And I think the great thing about this pandemic is that we had the opportunity to go online and learn about whatever we wanted, right? I mean, the fact that we had we have computers and so on was helpful in many ways. You know, you can buy things online, get your groceries and so on, talk on Zoom. But it also gave people an opportunity. They were stuck at home. And what they did, they went online. And we actually have done the research that we're writing up now. Turns out what they did is they went online and they asked a lot more why and what than ever before. And this is a proportion of all searches. It's not just that they went on, I mean, obviously we went online more, we read more and so on, but we specifically were asking a lot of why and what, and also how, right? As you said, how do I make bread? How do I use Zoom? How do I make a mask out of socks? But also they were just asking just general knowledge because you're stuck at home and there's a threat going on. And I think one of the reactions is, I need to know more stuff.
I mean, it is great that we can bring an optimistic frame to the situation that we've been in recently. As we've discussed, we're pretty hardwired to find the optimism in this. But I suppose we should also be mindful of the fact that there will be probably people listening to this who would not consider themselves optimistic and would be navigating more the horror of what's been going on and a sense of despair of what's going on. I suppose this sort of brings us back to what we were saying earlier a little bit, that how to strike that balance between challenging the biases and wanting to be as realistic as we can be about the situation that we're in, whether the pandemic or just in general as human beings, and sort of embracing optimism as an evolutionary function that gets us out of all sorts of difficulties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you asked this question, because I usually when I talk about how people have adapted so well and on average happiness went back to baseline within a month of the pandemic, I usually remember to say something about the caveat, which is quite important, which is this is only a bird's eye view of the average response. Right. But if you go in and look at subpopulations, you absolutely see there are subpopulations that have not adapted, that are having a very hard time. Who are these subpopulations? One, people with a predisposition to mental health. Two, income matters. The number one predictor of happiness during the pandemic was a sense of control. People with greater sense of control were happier. The number two was income, right? So people with less income were definitely not adapting as well. The idea here is simply that to adapt well, if you had more income, it was easier, right? If you can use your money to do all sorts of things that you need to do, during the pandemic, like a lot of people, you know, if they were living in the middle of the city and they had money and they had a second home, they just moved to that second home, right? So these things really matter for how you react to the pandemic. And again, it's true that potentially after a certain amount, it wouldn't matter anymore. And then people who are living alone weren't doing as well as people who are not living alone. Again, obvious reason why. Females were not doing as well as males, potentially because they were taking more responsibilities over things like childcare and housework. So I don't want to give a view that everyone is adapted within a month. It's just the average that we see in the population.
And the consistent theme through so much of what we've been talking about is that sense of agency and control. And to some extent, there's always a bit of an illusion in that, but it does seem to me to be something that I keep coming back to in terms of both what is effective as a political campaign message and actually effective in policy, in the practical policy that you implement, things that give the individual a sense that they have agency in the outcome. They're going to be more satisfied with, you know, the service that was delivered. And they're going to be more comfortable and happy with the society they're living in because they feel they had some input into the output that they got.
Yeah, absolutely. Whenever you can give people a choice. So one way to enhance a sense of control is giving people a choice. And when you can do that, that usually has positive, it's usually beneficial for people's well-being. So for example, in many states in the US, parents were given an option whether to go fully online, hybrid, or in person. Some schools, some districts gave all three options, some gave two options, but almost always you had an option to choose.
I mean, I don't want to get too much into the politics of this now because I'm going to let you go in a second, but there is presumably some tension there in terms of you want to give people that sense of agency and control, whereas realistically in a national emergency, there's an element of saying you've just got to do what you're told, and this is what it is. You don't, you know, it's very hard to give people a sense of agency and control when you're also saying stay in your house, don't go out.
So I think policy is very, very important. If you want, at the end of the day, if you need people to do something, policy is the answer, right? So for example, if there's a rule and it says you cannot go into a grocery store without your mask and there's someone in the entrance making sure you don't, that's what's going to make the biggest difference, right? So undoubtedly, the solution is always, if you want people to do, if it's very, very important and you need them to do a certain thing, you have to put in the policy in place. That being said, you always need to do the best that you can to frame it as why it's advantageous for individuals. And this is where we had a little bit of optimistic data that we found that people were, they didn't think they would be infected perhaps as much as they should, but they thought other people around them would. And so a lot of people did what they had to do to mitigate risk, not for themselves, but for other people around them. And I think this is where actually the UK messaging got it exactly right, because their message was stay at home, save lives, save the NHS, right? It wasn't stay at home, save your own life. It was stay at home, save lives. So it had two things that it did, three things that it did exactly right. It was focusing on the positive, you are saving, right? It was focusing on saving others because people kind of underestimated their own risk, but not necessarily those of others. And it also gave you a sense of control. You are doing something to achieve some kind of outcome.
Tali, Sharat, thank you so much for giving us so much of your time and insight. I feel my mostly caveman brain has really been bathed in some quite high cognition, high level information here, and feeling more optimistic as a result, which I know is a bias, but I think in this case, it's a rationally informed one and I'm going to embrace it. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And that's it for another episode of Politics on the Couch. It just remains for me to once again thank Professor Tali Sharat, to thank Phil, the producer, for all the work he does making this podcast possible, and ultimately, of course, to thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.